They all fell silent, their faces long and listening. Brian thought he heard something, then decided it was the sound of his own heart, or simply imagination. "I want to go out by the windows again," Nick said abruptly. He stepped over Craig's prone body without so much as a glance down and strode from the restaurant without another word.
"Hey," Bethany cried. "Hey, I want to come too."
Albert followed her. Most of the others trailed after. "What about you two?" Brian asked Laurel and Dinah.
"I don't want to go," Dinah said. "I can hear it as well as I want to from here."
She paused and added,
"But I'm going to hear it better, I think, if we don't get out of here soon."
Brian glanced at Laurel Stevenson. "I'll stay here with Dinah," she said quietly. "All right," Brian said. "Keep away from Mr. Toomey."
"Keep away from Mr. Toomey,"
Craig mimicked savagely from his place on the floor. He turned his head with an effort and rolled his eyes in their sockets to look at Brian.
"You really can't get away with this, Captain Engel. I don't know what game you and your limey friend think you're playing, but you can't get away with it. Your next piloting job will probably be running cocaine in from Columbia after dark. At least you won't be lying when you tell your friends all about what a crack pilot you are."
Brian started to reply, then thought better of it. Nick said this man was at least temporarily insane, and Brian thought Nick was right. Trying to reason with a madman was both useless and time-consuming. "We'll keep our distance, don't worry," Laurel said. She drew Dinah over to one of the small tables and sat down with her. "And we'll be fine." "All right," Brian said. "Yell if he starts trying to get loose." Laurel smiled wanly.
"You can count on it."
Brian bent, checked the tablecloth with which Nick had bound Craig's hands, then walked across the waiting room to join the others, who were standing in a line at the floor-to-ceiling windows. He began to hear it before he was halfway across the waiting room, and by the time he had joined the others, it was impossible to believe it was an auditory hallucination. "That girl's hearing is really remarkable," Brian thought. The sound was very faint, to him at least, but it was there, and it did seem to be coming from the east. Dinah had said it sounded like Rice Krispies after you poured milk over them. To Brian, it sounded more like radio static, the exceptionally rough static you get sometimes during periods of high sunspot activity. He agreed with Dinah about one thing, though. It sounded bad. He could feel the hairs on the nape of his neck stiffening in response to that sound. He looked at the others and saw identical expressions of frightened dismay on every face. Nick was controlling himself the best, and the young girl who had almost balked at using the slide, Bethany, looked the most deeply scared. But they all heard the same thing in the sound. Bad. Something bad on the way. Hurrying. Nick turned toward him. "What do you make of it, Brian? Any ideas?" "No," Brian said. "Not even a little one. All I know is that it's the only sound in town."
"It's not in town yet," Don said. "But it's going to be, I think. I only wish I knew how long it was going to take."
They were quiet again, listening to the steady hissing crackle from the east. And Brian thought, "I almost know that sound, I think. Not cereal and milk. Not radio static, but what? If only it wasn't so faint." But he didn't want to know. He suddenly realized that, and very strongly. He didn't want to know at all. The sound filled him with a bone-deep loathing.
"We do have to get out of here," Bethany said. Her voice was loud and wavery.
Albert put an arm around her waist, and she gripped his hand in both of hers, gripped it with panicky tightness.
"We have to get out of here right now."
"Yes," Bob Jenkins said. "She's right. That sound, I don't know what it is, but it's awful. We have to get out of here." They were all looking at Brian, and he thought, "It looks like I'm the captain again, but not for long." Because they didn't understand. Not even Jenkins understood, sharp as some of his other deductions might have been, that they weren't going anywhere. Whatever was making that sound was on its way, and it didn't matter, because they would still be here when it arrived. There was no way out of that. He understood the reason why it was so, even if none of the others did. And Brian Engel suddenly understood how an animal caught in a trap must feel as it hears the steady thud of the hunter's approaching boots. Brian turned to look at the rider.
"You say we have to get out of here, right?"
"Yes, I think we must do that just as soon as we possibly..."
"And where do you suggest we go? Atlantic City? Miami Beach? Club Med?"
"You are suggesting, Captain Engel, that there's no place we can go?"
"I think, I hope, that you're wrong about that.
I have an idea, which is, in a moment. First, answer one question for me. Can you refuel the airplane? Can you do that even if there's no power?
I think so, yes. Well, let's say, with the help of a few able-bodied men, I could. Then what?
Then we take off again, Bob said. Little beads of sweat stood out on his deeply lined face. They looked like droplets of clear oil. That sound, that crunchy sound, is coming from the east. The time rip was several thousand miles west of here. If we retraced our original course, could you do that?
Yes, Brian said.
He had left the auxiliary power units running, and that meant the INS computer's program was still intact. That program was an exact log of the trip they had just made. From the moment Flight 29 had left the ground in Southern California until the moment it had set down in central Maine. One touch of a button would instruct the computer to simply reverse that course. The touch of another button, once in the air, would put the autopilot to work flying it. The Teledyne inertial navigation system would recreate the trip down to the smallest degree deviations. I could do that. But why?
Because the rip may still be there. Don't you see? We might be able to fly back through it.
Nick looked at Bob in sudden, startled concentration, then turned to Brian.
He might have something there, mate. He just might.
Albert Costner's mind was diverted onto an irrelevant but fascinating sidetrack. If the rip were still there, and if Flight 29 had been on a frequently used altitude and heading, a kind of east-west avenue in the sky, then perhaps other planes had gone through it between 1:07 this morning and now, whenever now was. Perhaps there were other planes landing or landed at other deserted American airports, other crews and passengers wandering around, stunned. No, he thought. We happen to have a pilot on board. What are the chances of that happening twice? He thought of what Mr. Jenkins had said about Ted Williams's 16 consecutive on bases and shivered. He might or he might not, Brian said. It doesn't really matter because we're not going any place in that plane.
Why not? Rudy asked. If you could refuel, I don't see...
Remember those matches? The one from the bowl in the restaurant? The ones that wouldn't light?
Rudy looked blank, but an expression of huge dismay dawned on Bob Jenkins' face. He put his hand to his forehead and took a step backwards. He actually seemed to shrink before them.
What?
Don asked. He was looking at Brian from beneath drawn-together brows. It was a look which conveyed both confusion and suspicion.
What does that have to do?
But Nick knew.
Don't you see? He asked quietly.
Don't you see, mate? If batteries don't work, if matches don't light...
Then jet fuel won't burn, Brian finished. It will be as used up and worn out as everything else in this world. He looked at each one of them in turn.
I might as well fill up the fuel tanks with molasses.
Have either of you fine young ladies ever heard of the Langoliers?
Craig asked suddenly. His tone was light, almost vivacious. Laurel jumped and looked nervously toward the others, who were still standing by the windows and talking. Dinah only turned toward Craig's voice, apparently not surprised at all.
No, she said calmly. What are those?
Don't talk to him, Dinah, Laurel whispered.
I heard that, Craig said in the same pleasant tone of voice. Dinah's not the only one with sharp ears, you know.
Laurel felt her face grow warm.
I wouldn't hurt the child anyway, Craig went on. No more than I would have hurt that girl. I'm just frightened. Aren't you?
Yes, Laurel snapped. But I don't take hostages and then try to shoot teenage boys when I'm frightened.
You didn't have what looked like the whole front line of the Los Angeles Rams caving in on you at once, Craig said. And that English fellow. He laughed.
The sound of his laughter in this quiet place was disturbingly merry, disturbingly normal.
Well... All I can say is, if you think I'm crazy, you haven't been watching him at all. That man's got a chainsaw for a mind.
Laurel didn't know what to say. She knew it hadn't been the way Craig Toomey was presenting it, but when he spoke, it seemed as though it should have been that way. And what he said about the Englishman was too close to the truth. The man's eyes. And the kick he'd chopped into Mr. Toomey's ribs after he'd been tied up. Laurel shivered.
What are the Langoliers, Mr. Toomey? Dinah asked.
Well, I always used to think they were just make-believe, Craig said in the same good-humored voice. Now I'm beginning to wonder.
because I hear it too, young lady. Yes, I do.
The sound? Dinah asked softly. That sound is the Langoliers?
Laura put one hand on Dinah's shoulder. I really wish you wouldn't talk to him anymore, honey. He makes me nervous.
Why? He's tied up, isn't he?
Yes, but...
And you could always call for the others, couldn't you? Well, I think... I want to know about the Langoliers.
With some effort, Craig turned his head to look at them. And now Laurel felt some of the charm and force of personality which had kept Craig firmly on the fast track as he worked out the high-pressure script his parents had written for him. She felt this even though he was lying on the floor with his hands tied behind him and his own blood drying on his forehead and left cheek. My father said the Langoliers were little creatures that lived in closets and sewers and other dark places.
Like elves? Dinah wanted to know.
Craig laughed and shook his head. Nothing so pleasant, I'm afraid. He said that all they really were was hair and teeth and fast little legs. Their little legs were fast, he said, so they could catch up with bad boys and girls no matter how quickly they scampered.
Stop it, Laurel said coldly. You're scaring the child. No, he's not, Dinah said. I know make-believe when I hear it. It's interesting, that's all.
Her face said that it was something more than interesting, however. She was intent, fascinated.
It is, isn't it? Craig said, apparently pleased by your interest. I think what Laurel means is that I'm scaring her. Do I win the cigar, Laurel? If so, I'd like an El Producto, please. None of those cheap white owls for me. He laughed again.
Laurel didn't reply. And after a moment, Craig resumed.
My dad said there were thousands of Langoliers. He said there had to be, because there were millions of bad boys and girls scampering about the world. That's how he always put it. My father never saw a child run in his entire life. They always scampered. I think he liked that word because it implies senseless, directionless, non-productive motion. But the Langoliers, they run. They have purpose. In fact, you could say that the Langoliers are purpose personified.
What did the kids do that was so bad? Dinah asked. What did they do that was so bad the Langoliers had to run after them?
You know, I'm glad you asked that question, Craig said. Because when my father said someone was bad, Dinah, what he meant was lazy. A lazy person couldn't be part of the big picture. No way. In my house, you were either part of the big picture, or you were lying down on the job. And that was the worst kind of bad you could be. Throat cutting was a venial sin compared to lying down on the job. He said that if you weren't part of the big picture, the Langoliers would come and take you out of the picture completely. He said you'd be in your bed one night, and then you'd hear them coming, crunching and smacking their way toward you. And even if you tried to scamper off, they'd get you. Because of their fast little...
That's enough, Laurel said. Her voice was flat and dry.
The sound is out there, though, Craig said.
His eyes regarded her brightly, almost roguishly.
You can't deny that. The sound really is out there.
Stop it, or I'll hit you with something myself.
Okay, Craig said. He rolled over on his back, grimaced, and then rolled further, onto his other side and away from them.
A man gets tired of being hit when he's down and hogtied.
Laurel's face grew not just warm, but hot this time. She bit her lip and said nothing. She felt like crying. How was she supposed to handle someone like this? How? First the man seemed as crazy as a bedbug, and then he seemed as sane as could be. And meanwhile, the whole world, Mr. Toomey's big picture, had gone to hell.
I bet you were scared of your dad, weren't you, Mr. Toomey?
Craig looked back over his shoulder at Dinah, startled. He smiled again. But this smile was different. It was a rueful, hurt smile with no public relations in it.
This time, you win the cigar, miss, he said. I was terrified of him.
Is he dead?
Yes.
Was he lying down on the job? Did the Langoliers get him?
Craig thought for a long time. He remembered being told that his father had had his heart attack while in his office. When his secretary buzzed him for his 10 o'clock staff meeting and there was no answer, she had come in to find him dead on the carpet, eyes bulging, foam drying on his mouth. Did someone tell you that? He wondered suddenly. That his eyes were bugging out? That there was foam on his mouth? Did someone actually tell you that? Mother, perhaps, when she was drunk? Or was it just wishful thinking?
Mr. Toomey, did they?
Yes, Craig said thoughtfully. I guess he was, and I guess they did.
Mr. Toomey?
What?
I'm not the way you see me. I'm not ugly. None of us are.
He looked at her, startled. How would you know how you look to me, little blind miss?
You might be surprised, Dinah said.
Laurel turned toward her, suddenly more uneasy than ever. But of course there was nothing to see. Dinah's dark glasses defeated curiosity. The other passengers stood on the far side of the waiting room, listening to that low, rattling sound and saying nothing. It seemed there was nothing left to say.
What do we do now? Don asked.
He seemed to have wilted inside his red lumberjack's shirt. Albert thought the shirt itself had lost some of its cheerfully macho vibrancy.
I don't know, Brian said.
He felt a horrible impotence toiling away in his belly. He looked out at the plane, which had been his plane for a little while, and was struck by its clean lines and smooth beauty. The Delta 727 sitting to its left at the jetway looked like a dowdy matron by comparison.
It looks good to you because it's never going to fly again, that's all. It's like glimpsing a beautiful woman for just a moment in the back seat of a limousine. She looks even more beautiful than she really is because you know she's not yours. Can never be yours.
How much fuel is left, Brian? Nick asked suddenly.
Maybe the burn rate isn't the same over here. Maybe there's more than you realize.
All the gauges are in apple pie working order, Brian said. When we landed, I had less than 600 pounds. To get back to where this happened, we'd need at least 50,000. Bethany took out her cigarettes and offered the pack to Bob. He shook his head. She stuck one in her mouth, took out her matches, and struck one. It didn't light.
Uh-oh, she said.
Albert glanced over. She struck the match again and again and again. There was nothing. She looked at him, frightened. Here, Albert said, let me. He took the matches from her hand and tore another one loose. He struck it across the strip on the back. There was nothing.
Whatever it is, it seems to be catching,
Rudy Warwick observed. Bethany burst into tears, and Bob offered her his handkerchief. Wait a minute, Albert said, and struck the match again. This time it lit, but the flame was low, guttering, unenthusiastic. He applied it to the quivering tip of Bethany's cigarette, and a clear image suddenly filled his mind. A sign he had passed as he rode his 10-speed to Pasadena High School every day for the last 3 years. Caution, this sign said. Two-way traffic ahead. What in the hell does that mean? He didn't know, at least not yet. All he knew for sure was that some idea wanted out, but was, at least for the time being, stuck in the gears. Albert shook the match out. It didn't take much shaking. Bethany drew on her cigarette, then grimaced.
Blech. It tastes like a Carlton or something.
Blow smoke in my face, Albert said.
What?
You heard me. Blow some in my face. She did as he asked, and Albert sniffed at the smoke. Its former sweet fragrance was now muted. Whatever it is, it seems to be catching. Caution. Two-way traffic ahead.
I'm going back to the restaurant, Nick said.
He looked depressed.
Young Cassius has a lean and slippery feel. I don't like leaving him with the ladies for too long.
Brian started after him and the others followed. Albert thought there was something a little amusing about these tidal flows. They were behaving like cows which sense thunder in the air.
Come on, Bethany said. Let's go.
She dropped her half-smoked cigarette into an ashtray and used Bob's handkerchief to wipe her eyes. Then she took Albert's hand. They were halfway across the waiting room, and Albert was looking at the back of Mr. Gaffney's red shirt when it struck him again, more forcibly this time. Two-way traffic ahead.
Wait a minute, he yelled.
He suddenly slipped an arm around Bethany's waist, pulled her to him, put his face into the hollow of her throat, and breathed in deeply.
Oh, my, we hardly know each other, Bethany cried.
Then she began to giggle helplessly and put her arms around Albert's neck. Albert, a boy whose natural shyness usually disappeared only in his daydreams, paid no notice. He took another deep breath through his nose. The smells of her hair, sweat, and perfume were still there, but they were faint, very faint. They all looked around, but Albert had already let Bethany go and was hurrying back to the windows.
"Wow," Bethany said. She was still giggling a little and blushing brightly. "Strange dude."
Albert looked at Flight 29 and saw what Brian had noticed a few minutes earlier. It was clean and smooth and almost impossibly white. It seemed to vibrate in the dull stillness outside. Suddenly, the idea came up for him. It seemed to burst behind his eyes like a firework. The central concept was a bright, burning ball. Implications radiated out from it like fiery spangles, and for a moment he quite literally forgot to breathe.
"Albert," Bob asked. "Albert, what's wrong?"
"Captain Engel!" Albert screamed. In the restaurant, Laurel sat bolt upright, and Dinah clasped her arm with hands like talons. Craig Toomey craned his neck to look. "Captain Engel, come here!" Outside, the sound was louder. To Brian, it was the sound of radio static. Nick Hopewell thought it sounded like a strong wind rattling dry tropical grasses. Albert, who had worked at McDonald's the summer before, was reminded of the sound of French fries in a deep fat fryer. And to Bob Jenkins, it was the sound of paper being crumpled in a distant room. The four of them crawled through the hanging rubber strips and then stepped down into the luggage unloading area, listening to the sound of what Craig Toomey called the Langoliers. "How much closer is it?" Brian asked Nick.
"Can't tell. It sounds closer, but of course we were inside before."
"Come on," Albert said impatiently. "How do we get back aboard? Climb the slide?" "Won't be necessary," Brian said and pointed. A rolling stairway stood on the far side of gate 2. They walked toward it, their shoes clopping listlessly on the concrete. "You know what a long shot this is, don't you, Albert?" Brian asked as they walked.
"Yes, but..." "Long shots are better than no shots at all," Nick finished for him.
"I just don't want him to be too disappointed if it doesn't pan out."
"Don't worry," Bob said softly. "I will be disappointed enough for all of us."
The lad's idea makes good logical sense.
"It should prove out. Although, Albert, you do realize there may be factors here which we haven't discovered, don't you?"
"Yes." They reached the rolling ladder and Brian kicked up the foot brakes on the wheels. Nick took a position on the grip which jutted from the left railing, and Brian laid hold of the one on the right. "I hope it still rolls," Brian said.
"It should," Bob Jenkins answered. "Some, perhaps even most, of the ordinary physical and chemical components of life seem to remain in operation. Our bodies are able to process the air. Doors open and close."
"Don't forget gravity," Albert put in.
"The Earth still sucks." "Let's quit talking about it and just try it," Nick said.
The stairway rolled easily. The two men trundled it across the tarmac toward the 767 with Albert and Bob walking behind them. One of the wheels squeaked rhythmically. The only other sound was that low, constant crunch, rattle, crunch from somewhere over the eastern horizon.
"Look at it," Albert said as they neared the 767. "Just look at it. Can't you see? Can't you see how much more there it is than anything else?"
There was no need to answer, and no one did. They could all see it. And reluctantly, almost against his will, Brian began to think the kid might have something. They set the stairway at an angle between the escape slide and the fuselage of the plane, with the top step only a long stride away from the open door. "I'll go first," Brian said. "After I pull the slide in, Nick, you and Albert roll the stairs into better position."
"Aye, aye, Captain,"
Nick said, and clipped off a smart little salute, the knuckles of his first and second fingers touching his forehead. Brian snorted. "Junior attaché," he said, and then he ran fleetly up the stairs. A few moments later, he had used the escape slide's lanyard to pull it back inside. Then he leaned out to watch as Nick and Albert carefully maneuvered the rolling staircase into position, with its top step just below the 767's forward entrance. Rudy Warwick and Don Gaffney were now babysitting Craig. Bethany, Dinah, and Laurel were lined up at the waiting room windows looking out.
"What are they doing?" Dinah asked.
"They've taken away the slide and put a stairway by the door," Laurel said. "Now they're going up." She looked at Bethany. "You're sure you don't know what they're up to?" Bethany shook her head.
"All I know is that Ace, Albert, I mean, almost went nuts. I'd like to think it was this mad sexual attraction, but I don't think it was."
She paused, smiled, and added,
"At least, not yet. He said something about the plane being more there and my perfume being less there, which probably wouldn't please Coco Chanel or whatever her name is, and two-way traffic. I didn't get it. He was really jabbering.
I bet I know, Dinah said.
What's your guess, hon?
Dinah only shook her head. I just hope they hurry up, because poor Mr. Toomey is right. The Langoliers are coming. Dinah, that's just something his father made up.
Maybe once it was make-believe, Dinah said, turning her sightless eyes back to the windows. But not anymore.
All right, Ace, Nick said. On with the show.
Albert's heart was thudding, and his hands shook as he set the four elements of his experiment out on the shelf in first class, where, 1,000 years ago and on the other side of the continent, a woman named Melanie Trevor had supervised a carton of orange juice and two bottles of champagne. Brian watched closely as Albert put down a book of matches, a bottle of Budweiser, a can of Pepsi, and a peanut butter and jelly sandwich from the restaurant cold case. The sandwich had been sealed in plastic wrap.
Okay, Albert said, and took a deep breath. Let's see what we got here.
Don left the restaurant and walked over to the windows.
What's happening?
Wait out now, Bethany said.
She had managed to coax a flame from another of her matches and was smoking again. When she removed the cigarette from her mouth, Laurel saw she had torn off the filter.
They went inside the plane. They're still inside the plane. End of story.
Don gazed out for several seconds.
It looks different outside. I can't say just why, but it does.
The light's going, Dinah said. That's what's different.
Her voice was calm enough, but her small face was an imprint of loneliness and fear.
I can feel it going.
She's right, Laurel agreed. It's only been daylight for 2 or 3 hours, but it's already getting dark again.
I keep thinking this is a dream, you know, Don said. I keep thinking it's the worst nightmare I've ever had, but I'll wake up soon.
Laurel nodded. How is Mr. Toomey? Don laughed without much humor.
You won't believe it.
Won't believe what? Bethany asked.
He's gone to sleep.
Craig Toomey, of course, was not sleeping. People who fell asleep at critical moments, like that fellow who was supposed to have been keeping an eye out while Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, were most definitely not part of the big picture. He had watched the two men carefully through eyes which were not quite shut, and willed one or both of them to go away. Eventually, the one in the red shirt did go away. Warwick, the bald man with the big false teeth, walked over to Craig and bent down. Craig let his eyes close all the way.
Hey, Warwick said. Hey, you wake?
Craig lay still, eyes closed, breathing regularly. He considered manufacturing a small snore and thought better of it. Warwick poked him in the side. Craig kept his eyes shut and went on breathing regularly. Baldy straightened up, stepped over him, and went to the restaurant door to watch the others. Craig cracked his eyelids and made sure Warwick's back was turned. Then, very quietly and very carefully, he began to work his wrists up and down inside the tight figure eight of cloth which bound them. The tablecloth rope felt looser already. He moved his wrists in short strokes, watching Warwick's back, ready to cease movement and close his eyes again the instant Warwick showed signs of turning around. He willed Warwick not to turn around. He wanted to be free before the assholes came back from the plane, especially the English asshole, the one who had hurt his nose and then kicked him while he was down. The English asshole had tied him up pretty well. Thank God it was only a tablecloth instead of a length of nylon line. Then he would have been out of luck, but as it was, one of the knots loosened, and now Craig began to rotate his wrists from side to side. He could hear the Langoliers approaching. He intended to be out of here and on his way to Boston before they arrived. In Boston, he would be safe. When you were in a boardroom filled with bankers, no scampering was allowed. And God help anyone, man, woman, or child, who tried to get in his way.